Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The story, as they say, is all over the map. News about preparations for another war in the Gulf comes in bits and pieces, from high-speed troop-carrying catamarans reportedly being purchased in Australia to stories from North Carolina about the dramatic increases in base activities. The Army, the Navy, the Marines, and the Air Force are all printing up new letterhead with names like Bahrain, Qatar, Kuwait, and Diego Garcia. There's no doubt that the threat of force is an essential part of persuading Saddam Hussein to accept the weapons inspectors, so the force must be shown to be real. Connection listeners, how much needs to be committed? Is there a point at which moving bombs and ships to the Gulf means that combat is inevitable? And here's another question. Previous wars in Iraq and Kosovo and Afghanistan have shown that modern war can be waged without significant American casualties. On this Veterans Day, our questions about what lies ahead on your mind. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests today are the retired Major General William Nash. He was in the field in the Gulf War in Bosnia and in Kosovo. He's currently Director of the Center for Preventative Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're also joined by retired Colonel Kenneth Allard. He served with General Nash in Bosnia. He's author of Command, Control, and the Common Defense, and he's an adjunct professor in the National Security Studies Program at Georgetown University. And we also have with us Bradley Graham, military and foreign affairs correspondent for The Washington Post. He's been covering the recent military buildup. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you very much. Good to be back with The Connection.
Nice to have you here. Bradley Graham, let me start with you, because it's your work and that of others that I was trying to scrabble together to get a sense of the military build. And I'm curious to know if it's an easy story to research and to report.
Not particularly. I mean, there's some of these build-up moves that can't be hidden. But the Pentagon has not made a point of announcing each of the deployments as they've been ordered. Their policy has been that if anybody happens to notice them, defense officials will confirm them. But we've had to sort of piece them together as they've been happening in recent weeks and months.
Now, Bradley, you've been at this a long time. So when you saw the story in the weekend papers about the supposedly specific war plan that would see the United States moving swiftly from the north and from the west and from the south and then encircling Baghdad and so on and so forth, was there a bit of suspicion in your mind about that?
Not really. I mean, one of the stories was in the Washington Post. It was written by a colleague, Tom Ricks.
Right, I saw.
New York Times had another story. It was somewhat coincidental that they came out at the same time. USA Today, I think, has a story in today's editions. Now, it might seem to many readers, and I wouldn't blame many for thinking that this was some kind of calculated effort by the administration to describe the broad outlines of a military campaign, possibly for the purpose of further pressuring Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi regime with what they might be in for. But at least knowing what went into the Washington Post story, I can say that nobody handed that one to us. That took some days and weeks of piecing together little items that a number of those who may be familiar with one aspect or another of the war plan had disclosed to us.
So, quick overview, Bradley. What's on the ground now?
At the moment, there is quite a substantial force already in the region. There are two aircraft carriers within striking distance of Iraq. Scores of warplanes that have been in the area for years already enforcing the no-fly zones over northern and southern Iraq. There are more conventional ground forces in Kuwait, almost a brigade's worth, that have been on a continuous training exercise. There's an unspecified number of special forces, special operations forces that are in the region. And there is one heck of a lot of pre-positioned equipment in the Gulf states and afloat in the waters of the Gulf and the Indian Ocean, as well as a lot more stuff that that is on its way.
Colonel Kenneth Allard, this sounds very much like a buildup.
It's Allard, actually.
I'm sorry about that.
And indeed, it is a buildup. What I think you're seeing here is very much, as you indicated in your setup, the fact that diplomacy really does need to be accompanied by military force, especially when you're dealing with Saddam Hussein. And while this has been a very, very quiet deployment as far as that has gone, I think it's been a very, very effective one from the standpoint of understanding what needs to be done if the objective is, in fact, changing the regime. That is not something which can be done from 30,000 feet. It clearly will require the actual use of ground forces if it comes to that, and I think we're beginning to see that buildup taking place right now.
General Nash, when all the hardware is being moved in, and as I listen to Bradley's description of the pre-positioning, do you see this as preparations for a war or a warning for Iraq to make the way clear for the weapons inspectors?
Well, I think the answer to your question is yes, it is both. And the fact of the matter is that this buildup gives you both a capacity to wage war, and it also sends the message of that willingness and commitment. Therefore, continuing the squeeze on Saddam in conjunction with UN resolutions, the meeting recently of the Arab League, and I think that it's the case where deterrence works best when it's real. And I think it's being made very clear to Saddam Hussein that there's a seriousness to this effort that he has not seen since 1991.
And in your view, is it the sort of plan that is being put together to adapt to any sort of circumstances, or is it all leading towards one very specific military plan based on what we know?
Well, that's an interesting question and a difficult one to answer. As the number of forces increase, in, both in terms of overall size, but also the different types of forces are gathered. Bradley did mention the Marine forces, but you can be rest assured that they'll be there in more than plenty of time. The ability to stage from distance bases that are either from the United States or from advanced bases, not necessarily in the Mideast, but not too far away. It's necessary not only to build up a base capacity or a base force to conduct the operations, but things in war don't always go according to plan, and you have to have the flexibility and the agility to react to circumstances. So I think that's we haven't seen all of that yet. The other thing that hadn't been mentioned yet is the need for reserve forces, both to sustain the operation, and then, of course, we have to look at what is affectionately known as the day after, where do we go from there, and that'll require additional forces.
And Colonel Allard, that's something that's new in this plan. Something the day after part has never been as much a part of some sort of consideration of a buildup, has it?
One of the best lessons I ever learned was when I was a student in Britain, and a very distinguished British military historian said that the problem with you Americans is the fact that very seldom do you ever get around to asking the question, what will you do if you win? And it's very clear that that was not a particularly strong point of our planning last time out, and it needs to be in this particular instance. And I think it really does underline the fact that this is not merely about war fighting. This really is likely to be about nation building. You simply can't go drop bombs and walk away. And it's very, very clear that Clausewitz was right. This is politics by other means. But when those other means have accomplished their objective, then you have to get very serious, it seems to me, about what do we do that day after. And some of the interesting estimates that I've seen from particularly the Association of the United States Army, they've estimated that you're talking roughly 75,000 troops simply to go in and occupy that place, to give a subsequent government a chance, because all progress is made from stable platforms, and you have got literally no choice except to guarantee a certain baseline of stability in that country following any kind of a military campaign.
I think it's that aspect that has given pause more than any other factor to some of the senior military officials at the Pentagon about the whole idea of invading Iraq. I mean, there seems to be widespread confidence that U.S. forces could get the job done. The big concern is what would come after, and the kind of U.S. military commitment that would be required to rebuild the country.
Bradley, you were writing, I think, also on the weekend about the dilemma that the Pentagon faces, not sending too much in too quickly. What's the downside of that? What were you pointing to?
The problem in continuing this buildup at the rate that it seemed to be going was that the Pentagon would end up with a lot of forces positioned in the region that would then have to just sit and wait in the sand or offshore. And this would cut into operational efficiency and morale, and you'd end up with a tired force if the whole inspections process drags out for months and months. And so the dilemma facing the Pentagon now is how to sustain a force in the region that remains credible, that achieves its objective of both keeping the pressure on Saddam Hussein and being ready to respond should the inspections process fall apart or there be some kind of provocation on the part of Iraq. But on the other hand, that doesn't tire the force out. And I think the Bush administration is only now beginning to turn to where that balance really is and trying to figure out just how much longer and how much farther to continue this buildup.
Colonel Allard, is there a point where taking a certain volume of troops and equipment into that area makes the combat itself inevitable?
Well, if you take a look back at what Saddam Hussein tried to do during the run-up to Desert Storm, he actually tried to do a spoiling attack at the town of Kafji. And any time that you have the opportunity, when your enemy is getting ready to come after you, a spoiling attack makes certain sense. And all those Scuds and those other weapons that he claims he does not have are likely to come into play where if you do it this time as you did it during the Gulf War, we really can't afford to make that kind of mistake again because those large targets, we had logistics depots then that were 1 mile on a side, and they simply are targets for any kind of a missile attack, weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. And it would be really to invite that kind of thing. And so it's one more aspect of the timing. And the other point that I wanted to add to what Bradley just said is that while it's terribly troublesome to have troops sitting on their hands getting ready to go, it is an equally problematic thing for the logistics because you have to sustain those people. You have to feed them. You have to clothe them. You have to, give them stuff to drink every single day. You've got petroleum, oils, lubricants, all of that stuff. So it's not just the deployment. It is the sustainment that is such an enormous challenge for American military planners. It's an old saying that amateurs talk strategy, pros talk logistics, and there are some fairly impressive logistical considerations here.
Well, I just need to add that I wouldn't want to overstate that. While what Bradley and Ken say is true with respect of having a lot of folks over there and you have to sustain them, et cetera, number one, we're not talking about excessive periods of time. We're talking 6 months or less type ranges, and that's certainly within the doable. Also, I would point out that there's a phased deployment going on here, and the main mass of troops won't necessarily need to arrive to draw their pre-positioned equipment until a short time prior to employment. Meanwhile, they're back at their home stations, able to train and also be with their families.
Perhaps back at the home stations, but their minds very much on what might lie ahead. Connection listeners, yours too, I suspect. We invite you to join our conversation about the buildup. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Bradley Graham, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Bradley is a longtime military and foreign affairs correspondent for The Washington Post. He's also author of a book called Hit to Kill, The New Battle Over Shielding America from Missile Attack. Back right after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour, a conversation about the military buildup in the Gulf, what it means there, what it means to you, and what it means to those who are actually involved in it. With us on the program today, Major General William L. Nash, Senior Fellow and Director of the Center for Preventative Action Council on Preventative Action at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Colonel Kenneth Allard, an adjunct professor in the National Security Studies Program at Georgetown University. I have to get you guys to get simpler titles. 1-800-423-8255 is our number. And I want to ask both of you to help me with your sense of the weekend story that's supposedly outlined one battle plan, because I was left looking at that and wondering whether or not, not whether or not so much it was disinformation, but what's the purpose of having it out there? Is that some sort of reassurance for other Arab states? What's your sense of that? General Nash, maybe you can start on that.
Well, my sense is that, first of all, I don't consider it particularly sensational news. The fact that we're going to have air and ground attacks, we're going to come from multiple areas, from multiple locations to hit multiple directions to hit a wide variety of targets is certainly the method of operations of military forces. I tell people if they want to try to figure out what it's going to look like, look at the 1989 attack on Panama and combine that with a variant of the 1991 Desert Storm operation. And while there are a lot of differences, it'll give you an idea that there'll be a number of simultaneous attacks, air and ground, in the early days, designed to blind Saddam Hussein, cut his communications off, render his air defense useless, and disrupt his communications. And then they're going to go in and they're going to isolate him, and they're going to get him. The last simultaneous with all that, I would expect strikes on known or suspected weapons of mass destruction sites.
Okay. Colonel.
Well, you know, I find it kind of interesting because, you know, it's really kind of a symbol of this wired world that we live in, that we have such a profligate discussion of war plans prior to an operation kicking off. You know, the planners of the Normandy invasion probably rolling in their graves. but I just have to tell you that the one thing the Pentagon has learned is that you absolutely cannot control what the press is going to say, what the press is going to do. So the old idea that we can simply have that kind of censorship simply does not work. On the other hand, what you can do is to throw an awful lot more stuff into the game. And I think that's what we're seeing here. Now, Bradley Graham talked in the first segment about the fact that the Pentagon has not given him his stories, and he's a good enough reporter that he goes out and gets that stuff.
Yeah.
And the way to control that is not by simply sitting there trying to censor everything, but really it is to throw as much stuff into the game as you possibly can. Some things that are right, some things that are wrong. That said, I agree with General Nash's assessment, and it certainly underlines the fact that this one is entirely different from what we've seen over the last 10 years, where we'd simply fire a few cruise missiles, have a press conference, and be done with it. This is something which is very much intended to either convince Saddam Hussein that he has no alternative, or, failing that, to go in and do the job that will not end until that regime is changed out. And that really does involve the simultaneous attack in every single dimension, air, land, and sea. And this is real war as opposed to some of the other things that we've done more recently in American foreign policy.
The other point I would make is that while the news stories have covered a lot of general information, I rest pretty confident that those who know the specifics are not talking.
Colonel Allard, you said this is real war, unlike what people have seen in years past. Are you talking about the understanding on this side of the ocean about American casualties? And when we talk about the message of force that's being delivered to Saddam Hussein, there is another message there for people here at home.
Well, I think it very, very much is the fact that we have taken many of the wrong lessons over the last 10 or 11 years, both from our experience in Desert Storm, which we got the idea that we could endure kind of a casualty free war. And that impression was really underlined, unfortunately so, in Somalia, in Kosovo, and on various other places around the world. And that created the perception that Americans were averse to casualties. I don't think that has ever been correct. I think that, if anything, we tend to be, when our dander is up, a people that is not satisfied with anything less than total victory. But we are deeply opposed to the idea of spending the lives of our sons and daughters in an unwise, profligate kind of way. And so I think that's a very, very important adjustment we need to make in our thinking. An awful lot of that changed after 9/11, when the first 3,000-odd casualties of that war were simply civilians that came to work that day. But it really does require an adjustment in our thinking that when we want to do something serious, which overthrowing the regime in Iraq is a very, very, that is the most serious proposition I can think of offhand, that will not come without American casualties being suffered. And that simply is something that we have to think about, and it's appropriate that we do so on Veterans Day.
And General Nash, it also won't come if the war happens without civilian casualties in Iraq, and judging by the response around the world and in this country to civilians who have been killed in Afghanistan and in Kosovo, this is also an issue which has to be a part of the plan, no?
Well, it certainly does, and that's why you'll two factors. Number one, there'll be great care taken in the air targeting process to minimize collateral damage. But also, I would argue that the use of ground forces to attack military targets, by definition, will reduce the number of civilian casualties, because the war will be won in a more direct manner, as opposed to some of the indirect means that Colonel Allard had referred to earlier. Now, the major exception to all of this can be if we get involved in some serious urban combat and are unable to evacuate the non-combatants from the scene. And that is probably the greatest single risk that we face.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Chesapeake, Virginia. Richard's joining us. Hi, Richard.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
Sure. General Nash, I served with you in Bosnia. I was your NCOIC in the Russian Brigade.
All right. Good to be with you again, my friend.
Hey, sir. Same here. my comment is that any build-up that we're going to have, the soldiers will really want to get on in there and get their jobs done. Like in Bosnia, we went in and immediately was able to perform our mission. I'm also a Desert Storm veteran, where we, had to sit around the desert for a while, but it did not degrade our capability, and we were entertained, during the long wait, but we were able to complete our mission without any problems.
Richard, tell me in your view whether or not you think the soldiers who may be sent to the Gulf this time around are viewing it in any way that's different from what was in your mind going into Bosnia or into the Gulf in 1991?
I don't see it being any different. Other than our better weapons capability, but our missions are the same, and our attitudes their attitudes going in will be the same, is to follow orders and complete the missions.
The other thing I'd point out, first of all, those soldiers that are already there in the airmen, they're doing a lot of training and focusing. And I'd also point out that the privates of Desert Storm are now the sergeants. The lieutenants are the colonels, and the colonels are the generals. And there's a great capacity there and a knowledge and experience that will serve the nation well.
Richard, thanks for your call.
Hey, thank you, and nice talk with you, General Nash.
Okay, Iron Soldier.
All right, sir.
1-800-423-8255 to Pittsboro, North Carolina, and Siglinda is joining us. Hi there.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for giving me the time. I just really have to tell you people that I am really sick and tired of these fanfares of war. You keep whining and whining about the poor soldiers and this and that and how to get ready and keep them comfortable and, when their morale and this and that, and you don't give a damn about the poor people over there that are there waiting for you to come over there and just destroy them all. First with the sanctions and now with this. And this country needs to start having a little bit of shame and start really to build peace with peace, not with war.
Siglinda, as I listen to you speak, I'm thinking about the reports of a demonstration that I saw in Florence over the weekend with I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of people who were marching.
There was a million of people there.
Well, we're
and
not
2 million of people before that, and all over Europe. And here, nobody knows it because the press is totally controlled by the government. You call this democracy?
I saw it on the front page of my newspaper, Siglinda. I don't know whether or not it didn't show up in Pittsboro, North Carolina. But go ahead.
No, if I could. First of all, Siglinda brings us up correctly to say that we need to understand that when we commit to war, there is nothing humanitarian, kind, or gentle about the process. And it is, in fact, a very serious decision to be made. And the fact of the matter is Iraq, the Iraqi people have suffered greatly But they've suffered greatly because of Saddam Hussein, who remains a threat to his own people, remains a threat to his region. And I'm very pleased that the United States has tried to deal with this finally through the United Nations, and I give great hope to that process. And as Ken Allard pointed out early, that this is a combination of diplomacy and force. But the decision to go to war is most serious for the American people, and it's a most serious situation for the Iraqi people. So it is not something that is at all casual. And if we've given your listeners any thought that we're just talking about war because we like it, that is not the case. It is something that we would much prefer the inspection regime to solve for us.
Siglinda, is it in any way fair to make a parallel here between the way that Saddam Hussein is regarded in Iraq today and the way that Mussolini was regarded in Italy in the Second World War and the intervention of the Americans there?
I think the situation is very different. And I think that the people in this country does not have the right information about the rest of the world.
What's missing?
It's missing the fact that all over the world, there are people that totally oppose this war, and there are very good reasons to oppose it. I think that if this country would spend the money that is spending on the war for peace and for a better life for people all over the world, there would be no need for war.
Thanks for your call. Colonel Allard,
I would just say in response to that, I teach two courses at Georgetown that literally begin about 3000 BC, and it is the history of military technology. And I certainly echo the point that we would be a lot better off spending for peace rather than war. Unfortunately, those are not the lessons that you can reasonably draw from that very, very long and bloody history. It may very well come about to the point that what the listener talks about is something we actually see on this earth. Unfortunately, I think it was Plato that said that only the dead have seen the end of war. And as true as I think that is, I would also underline the fact that the way that we do war in the 21st century is qualitatively different from anything that we've seen before, simply because of the fact that we do involve or try to involve the United Nations. I think that what President Bush said to that body on the 12th of September of this year was an extraordinarily significant speech, because he said it has got to be something more than the League of Nations was. The UN has got to take the responsibility. And when the UN does, and when it speaks with one voice, as it did here last week, that is an extraordinarily powerful message to the rest of the world. That is literally all of humanity speaking to Iraq with one voice and saying, this is what you must do in the interest of the maintenance of peace and international security. And we can only hope that that voice and that military capability will act together to achieve a better result than we've gotten in the last 11 years from Saddam Hussein. What we are actually trying to do here is to prevent a much worse situation than what, unfortunately, I think we see in the short term.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. And coming straight out of that is, of course, the different perspective on what war is if you look at it from the perspective of the Iraqis. I mean, I was there in January 2001 at the 10th anniversary of the beginning of the Gulf War, and that week and for dozens of incidents ever since then, there have been attacks by British and American airplanes on different targets in southern Iraq, in northern Iraq, in the no-fly zone. So people in that country specifically don't really think or aren't being told that the war ever ended in the first place.
And that is precisely the point here, that when you take a look at what Saddam Hussein has actually done, as distinct from what he has said, it's very clear that he saw no effective end to that war. This has been a long and very, very exceedingly slow process. I won't go into the litany of all the things that Saddam has done, but I think that the Bush administration has been convinced for some time that it can get a lot worse, that we are very much in a race against time, and that I think that accounts for some of the urgency. I'm simply delighted, though, that they have at least taken the time to put in place the very firm diplomatic and international understandings that are the absolute key to whatever happens here. Hopefully something which convinces Saddam, against all of the historical evidence, that it is now in his best interest to comply. And failing that, that you then perform the basis for the construction of another international coalition which will succeed in bringing him down.
1-800-423-8255 is our number. Thanks to Siglinda for the call to Raleigh, North Carolina now. And Tim's on the line. Hi, Tim.
Hey, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks for calling.
I appreciate you taking my call. My question was for the panel. I just wanted to know, what their opinion was on the how effective the generals, the Iraqi generals, are in their military strategy.
And whether or not they're going to stick with Saddam Hussein?
Yes, that, and with the limited forces that they may have now, what's the, I guess, the best case scenario for them?
Or what? I want to try and be precise about this, Tim. Do you mean what are they doing now, or what's their best way of defending Baghdad?
Well, yes, the second part. What is their best situation for defending Baghdad?
General Nash?
Yeah, my assessment of the Iraqi forces as a consequence of my experience in Desert Storm and subsequent to that, spent a little time in the region, is not very high. I don't think the Iraqi forces have a capacity to withstand an attack of the United States and its allies at all. And the vast majority of the forces are poorly trained, poorly equipped, and frankly, poorly led. Again, the vast majority will, I believe, be quickly overcome. Having said that, there's probably an inner core that, while not necessarily very professional in nature, undoubtedly see that their only chance of survival is through Saddam, and that fighting could be very fierce and with no quarter. And we see examples of some of the West Bank actions where a non-professional force has been able to withstand severe pressure from a very professional Israeli force. And I would see the possibility of small examples of that. Unfortunately, a small example of that in a big city like Baghdad could be very, very difficult.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the what we know of the buildup in the Gulf and what it could mean for the different scenarios for war, or perhaps the scenario that would prevent war in the Persian Gulf if the Iraqi government decides to go along with the UN resolution. Word for word, letter for letter. 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBU.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name is Dick Gordon. This hour, conversation about build-up in the Gulf, what it means, what the different scenarios are, what the implications are. With us on the program today, Major General William L. Nash served for 34 years in the U.S. Army in Vietnam, Operation Desert Storm, Kosovo, and Colonel Kenneth Allard, an adjunct professor in the National Security Studies Program at Georgetown University, author of Command, Control, and the Common Defense, and as a command and control expert, served in 1996 on special assignment with the U.S. 1st Armored Division in Bosnia, along with Major General Nash. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. First to Northampton, Massachusetts. Simon's with us. Hi, Simon.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I have a comment and a question. And generally, I find the idea that Saddam Hussein is a direct threat to U.S. security, frankly, to be quite ridiculous. From what I've heard from the former U.N. weapons inspector Scott Ritter in Iraq and other sources, that the idea that he has weapons that are a direct threat to the United States or really our allies in the region, I just find totally unconvincing. What I'd like to say is that I think if you want to talk about American security in the world and American security in the region, you need to address the root causes of why Americans are hated so vehemently by so many in the Muslim world. And
Simon, back up. Just before we get to that, I mean, the United Nations Security Council did vote unanimously to say that, yes, in fact, the world needs to focus its attention on weapons of mass destruction. I mean, even this weekend, the Arab League endorsed that. It kind of sandpapers the edge off the idea that this is just some notion of Donald Rumsfeld, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, look at a gentleman like Scott Ritter. I mean, I think this guy has as much technical knowledge as you could ask for. He used to be the director of the UN Weapons Inspection Program in Iraq. And what he reports is that Iraq is 95%, we can document that they're 95% disarmed, and the remaining 5% is not an indication that they definitely have weapons of mass destruction. It's just the disarmament that we haven't actually been able to specifically document. So I find it unconvincing, and I think that the U.S. has put tremendous pressure on governments in the region to support this plan, and they've had to twist arms very aggressively in order to get any support for it.
And so to Colonel Allard or General Nash, I mean, well, we also have the president saying, ask me what we know about nuclear weapons, and I tell you, we don't really know.
Look, I think it's very important to listen to a number of voices here, and I know Scott Ritter, I've worked with him, and I would just simply tell you that the opinion in the national security community is that Scott has kind of gone off the deep end in wishing away what is clearly seen by most of the rest of the world as convincing evidence of a continuing Iraqi threat. The thing that I find kind of interesting here is the fact that I don't so much listen anymore to Scott Ritter, but I really take very seriously his former boss, Ambassador Richard Butler, when Ambassador Butler says that these people have been up to no good and that there are a number of things that have been lamentably unaccounted for in terms of the Iraqi missiles, weapons of mass destruction, all of these things, which have convinced a great number of people, not just in the United States government, but the British government and various others as well, that he does indeed represent precisely the threat which led to this UN resolution last week. So I think that you've got to pay some attention to that. And it doesn't require very much imagination to consider what would be the impact on the world, particularly the Western industrial democracies, if you had a nuclear-armed Saddam Hussein with that degree of proximity to 70% of the world's proven oil reserves. There are some people that will say that that's not a problem. I am, unfortunately, not one of them.
General Nash, one of the things that Scott Ritter said when he was on the program, though, was that he had reservations about just whether or not the United States military should be in the business of regime change, that taking Saddam Hussein out and, you know, who knows who will replace him. Is that what American lives should be risked for? What do you think about that?
Well, the issue is not the regime change. The issue is the threat change, which then may well lead you to the issue of changing Saddam Hussein's line of work. I count myself as skeptical as anybody else, having fought my first war on blind faith and been somewhat disappointed in that faith. I approach this problem with skepticism. But also the events of September 11th last year proved to us that hope is not a method. And we have, in fact, have got to deal with this potential threat. Saddam Hussein, as you correctly pointed out, has been acknowledged by the world and the region as a threat to peace and security and needs to be dealt with. But I think the way we're going about it now, after a lot of turbulence, is about right. In fact, mounting this inspection regime to go back to go in and verify Scott Ritter's claim, if you will, not necessarily. I kind of agree with Ken that he's not necessarily the best source of judgment. Is the appropriate way to go? There is a threat. The timeliness of the threat is a question. And it's probably better, though, if you consider, even if you say that he does not have nuclear weapons capacity today, given all that has happened, given the oppression that he brings to his people and to the region, this is probably a much better time to deal with that than it would be later on, given the potential for great harm to the nation and to our allies.
And worth the risk of American lives to do it now.
And worth the risk of the consequences. And some of those consequences, I agree, could be quite harmful.
Let me make one other comment, if I may, about Scott's comment about regime change. That is precisely why you have a military. While peacekeeping and nation building, I think, are continuing and important military functions, in fact, they go back to the 19th century. And General Nash led a brilliant one that we did in Bosnia that really did a tremendous amount of good for the people that live there. That is not the main mission. Okay, what people need to remember about their military is the fact that when it comes down to it, we do two things as core functions. We kill people, we break things. We do that when our political masters tell us that the national interest requires us to go do that, and only then. But precisely because, in this particular instance, President Bush has said it is going to be either one course of action or the other. And what the American people look to their military to do is to perform those very, very tough functions when the cause is just. And I share the general's feeling about the fact that there's room for some historical skepticism here, mm-hmm. because we have been deployed on far more exercises and enforced to do those kinds of things than I think in many cases the situations have required. That especially was the case with Vietnam. But in this particular instance, and underlining what happened last September the 11th, it is precisely the fact that I think we have come to understand that we talk very glibly about national security. We need to adjust our thinking. It is, in many cases, not so much national security as it is national survival.
Okay, but you use the words kill people and break things and refer back to September 11th in the resulting fighting in Afghanistan. The one thing that wasn't accomplished was the killing or capture of Osama bin Laden. If the United States goes into Iraq under the circumstances that we're describing this hour, and Saddam Hussein is neither killed nor captured, then in fact two leaders in the Arab world take on this mythic "we can't be got by the American military" status, and that's a real risk as well, is it not?
Well, I would just basically argue the opposite of that. And a point that I had to make here in Washington repeatedly, during these tragic events with the sniper, people are asking all the time about, can't the military get involved here? And I had to point out the fact that, look, the military does not do law enforcement kinds of things. We really do not go after individuals. But we do go after regimes when our political leaders tell us that that is now what our mission is. And we're very, very good at taking those kinds of regimes down. The general mentioned taking down the regime in Panama, which we did very successfully in a single night in 1989. We took down that regime literally in a matter of hours, but it took about another week or 10 days in one of the world's smallest countries, I might add, mm-hmm. to actually get after Manuel Antonio Noriega. That was a law enforcement problem. I think what we can very, very legitimately say that we can do is to take down the regime of Saddam Hussein. Whether we find him or not is frankly very much beside the point, as indeed it was in the case of Osama bin Laden. Not that I wouldn't love to see his face in somebody's crosshairs at some point.
General Nash,
we took down Afghanistan and that regime, and that was legitimately within our capabilities.
Well, when you make Osama bin Laden the a personification of the threat to America, and you fail to capture him, or prove his death, you obviously are subjected to criticism and questioning as to your efficiency or whatever. But the fact of the matter is the Afghanistan campaign has changed the regime, put Afghanistan back on the road to progress,
right.
and done significant, if not irreparable, damage to al-Qaeda network. Not that it is completely toothless, but its capacity has been greatly reduced. The same will be true in Iraq if it comes to that. And whether or not Saddam Hussein survives or not, or is found or not, the regime will be changed and he will not be the government of Iraq.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Green Bay, Wisconsin. Jim's on the line. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I've been serving in civil affairs for 14 years. I'm an NCO in the Army Reserve here in Green Bay. And I just wanted to bring up, since I had the opportunity to serve in Desert Storm and specifically in Operation Provide Comfort in Zaku, Iraq, what the role General Nash and Colonel Allard see for civil affairs and how they're an added asset that hasn't been talked about much.
General Nash, this is something that was specifically your task.
Well, very near and dear to my heart, and the Wisconsin civil affairs folks came to Bosnia, if I remember correctly, and provided great service in a variety of places. We talked earlier about the day after, and the civil affairs folks have the expertise necessary for the Army and the nation to deal with the day after, and they are going to be absolutely essential to the long-term success of any engagement or war, if you will, with Iraq. The fact of the matter is, as with Afghanistan, it is true in Iraq that when all is said and done, and we look back on this, if Iraq is not better tomorrow than it is today, then we will not have been as successful as we need to be. So the after nation busting comes nation building, as one of my colleagues says, and we have got to deal with that. And the civil affairs folks from Wisconsin and throughout the United States are crucial to our success.
I really can't add very much to that, except to say that I had the great privilege when I was getting ready to go over to Bosnia myself of doing my training with a reserve civil affairs battalion that had been called up for 270 days on active duty, precisely because they are such a unique capability, such a great national resource, and they were critical to us in Bosnia. One of the things that I think is at least out there potentially as sort of the problem of the day after in Iraq is precisely what it will take us in this country to wake up to the fact that our reserves are a tremendous national resource. They need to be sustained. And quite frankly, we have more missions than we have reservists. If you add in the homeland security component of that, in addition to these new missions in places like Iraq, one of the conclusions that I think you come to is that we have to urgently reexamine the whole basis on which we do our reserve policy. And frankly, raise that manpower.
I wonder if I can just step in here. We're a couple of minutes away from the end of the program, and I'd like to hear from both of you as students of military history when we talk on this Veterans Day about veterans and whether or not what we're discussing and what we will be talking about over the next months isn't that much more complicated than what we've seen in the past. I think of the veterans of the Second World War. There seemed to be simpler questions then and less so now. General Nash?
Well, I guess my initial reaction to that is we'd like to think we serve in a unique time and that the challenges to the military today in many ways probably are greater. But you look back, my father's service in World War II in the Pacific, the soldiers that faced the harsh conditions of Korea, the terrible confusion within the nation over our engagement in Vietnam. As you look at those three, of which I am either personally or family related to, I still maintain a degree of respect for our forefathers, if you will, and face the challenges of the day. We have many politically complicated situations today, and war has evolved in many ways. But it certainly not has changed the very essence of the nature of horrible, terrible conflict. So, yeah, it's tough today, but it was tough many years ago, and we have every need to honor our veterans.
Colonel Allard, I'm going to hope that that answer stands for you because we're right out of time.
I was simply going to say that while war has changed, the ideal of serving the nation has not.
Thank you both for being with me. Retired Major General William Nash and retired Colonel Kenneth Allard. Earlier in the program, Bradley Graham from The Washington Post. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
This is W.